All right, episode 25, Night of Living Dreads podcast. We got a wild ride tonight. As a matter of fact, our SMF and our main topic are one and the same. You'll find out what that is. Grab your helmets, folks. It's going to be a bumpy one. Here we go, episode 25, Night of Living Dreads. I am Otis B. Dreads. Mr. Malice is not with us. He's taking care of some kids on the home front. Completely understandable. I know he wanted to be here for tonight's show, but joining me is the one and only Mrs. Dreads. How are you, Jody?
I'm good.
Good. Because we got a really... a very interesting topic tonight, as mentioned in the intro. It's kind of a combination between our SMF and our main topic. But before we get into all the meat and potatoes of this week's show, got to hand out some love, of course, Gorehounds of Horror on Facebook. Go check them out. Closed group, but three simple questions will get you into the best damn horror group on Facebook. Misfit Fiend Horror Club, another new group there on Facebook. Check them out. Again, a closed group, but hey, simple questions will get you in. Let's see, what else do we have? We have After Dark, which is another horror-based, all three so far are horror-based Facebook groups. And one of the non, of course, Night of the Living Dreads, Dreads with no A, we're over there on Facebook as well. And for your daily dose of humor, check out Cannabis RK, Cannabis with a K. All great groups, Malice, myself, I know Jody here is a member of... probably most of them, if not all of them. And so you'll catch us over there as well. So with all the love being handed out, now we're going to get into some not-so-love. See, this tonight's topic, and I guess I'll just come right out and say it is Joseph James DeAngelo Jr. Now, I know that name probably does not ring a bell to a lot of people. It certainly didn't me until Malice brought it up a few weeks back. Have you ever heard of this guy? And you watch, Jody, you watch a lot of that true crime stuff and stuff on serial killers. Just, you know, one of the things we like to do. Have you ever heard of this guy's name?
No.
Never. I haven't either. Now, granted, his crimes and this story that we're going to talk about tonight happened out in the West Coast, California. But... not a lot of people have, you know, really heard of this guy. And I think that I completely forgot where I was going with all of that. I'm starting off just fantabulous. But Joseph James DeAngelo Jr. And this is a guy. And the reason I mentioned that I think that I'm excited to do this show is because this is a serial killer who's... well, a serial killer, but not just a serial killer. He took steps to work up to that point because some would say he was a serial burglar, which we'll get into those. That's not all confirmed that it was him, but a serial rapist and a serial murderer to the end of his murderous career. Where was I going with that? This is not turning out well at all. But he's somebody that, you know, people honestly don't know a whole lot of and about. And what makes this, again, special and unique is, well, he was just apprehended last April. Last April, I believe it was April 18th, 20th, 10th, 20th, right around in that time frame of 2018. Now, this, again, is a crime spree that some say could have spanned all the way back from 73 to 86. When it comes to what his most famous name given to him, that being the Golden State Killer, a lot of people will say from 76 to 86. Well, in that time, he completely eluded being caught. Some say it was like trying to catch a ghost. He would commit his murder and then off into the shadows. This lasted a good 40-some years before they were actually able to apprehend one of the most dangerous serial killers, if not the dangerous serial killers, in California state history. So it's almost kind of exciting to be in the midst of a story that a very heinous story, which we'll get into, about, you know, this guy who's able to just up and disappear into the shadows, and then here he's 74 years old, 73 or something, and is picked up for, you know, at least the murders, but we'll get into his charges later. First, let's just give a little history on this guy, where he came from. Who is Joseph James D'Angelo? He was born November 8th, 1945, in Bath, New York. He attended high school for a couple years, but apparently did not graduate because he obtained his GED in June of 64. Now, he enlisted in the Navy in September of 64, and then October to December in 64, he's in a naval training in San Diego. Between 65 and 68, he serves on the USS Canberra and the USS Piedmonet during the Vietnam War. So this guy, you know, he's enlisted a little bit, so we have some military background with him. In August of 68, he attends Sierra College in Rockland, California, and he gets his associate's degree in police science in 1970, December. He does get engaged in 70, but does not end up getting married. Poor guy. Spring of 71, he attends, CSU in Sacramento. June of 72, he gets his bachelor's degree in criminal science, so he's kind of working towards something in criminal justice. And let's see, he completes a 32-week of internship in Roseville Patrol. That was 72 to 73-ish. Now, here's where it starts getting interesting. In May of 73, some ransacking and burglaries start happening in a place called Visalia. And they named the person, the offender doing this, the Visalia Ransacker. What do you got for us, Jody, when it comes to the Visalia Ransacker? Because you were doing some research, and you got a lot more information than I did on some of these earlier crimes. Although I have, you know, read a bunch, but I just did not take notes. So what do you got for us as far as some of these early burglaries, whether, you know, Cordova and the Visalia ransackings?
Right. Well, it says it started in 72.
Right.
And that he'd do stuff like go into their house and drink their alcohol, eat their food. Only take, like, wallets and purses and coin collections. He wouldn't take anything of huge value. That was the time when he stole the dollar off the dresser.
Right, yeah, and I think as that story goes, if I remember correctly, he had woken up the mother and, you know, had proceeded to tell her that he took a dollar off of her dresser, off of her bureau. And she simply said, you know, well, you know, you need to put that back and you need to get out. So he, you know, I just see him as kind of like a, you know, a sad kid at that point, because he just kind of, you know, he complied. And what he did was he put $2 back on the dresser instead of the dollar. And then did not hurt her, and then left.
Well, he went to her daughter's room.
Right.
And
yeah.
She screamed at him too that he needed to leave.
And he turned.
So that's when he stole the 35 cents and left.
Yeah. It was a quarter and a nickel, I think. Yep. A quarter and a nickel he ends up taking, but leaves as demanded by the two women there.
That's, yeah.
Thought that was kind of funny. Anyway.
And he'd steal the single earrings.
Yeah, I mean, very strange kind of, I guess you could say, M.O. that he had with, you know, and again, we're talking about, you know, the Visalia. Was this the Visalia? Yeah, right around the same time the Visalia ransackings were going on. He had kind of, you know, very, very weird M.O. Like you said, he would steal like one earring from you know, the pair. I mean, what? And you said, like, and a lot of the things were not of, you know, a lot of value that you would think if somebody's breaking into your house, that they would sometimes he'd break in, not take anything.
I mean, like, out of it, he would do stuff out of inconvenience to make it inconvenient for you.
Right. He would, yeah, go in there and just dump all your clothes in the floor, you know, not take a damn thing, but just make a mess of your house.
Yeah, he'd separate the women's underwear, take them in a completely different room.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah.
He was not your standard everyday burglar.
No.
He had a very distinctive MO.
And if he broke into homes and they had a dog, he'd kill the dog.
Right.
If nobody was home.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he was
kind of
crazy.
He was. So, you know, you have these ransackings going on. It wasn't until, well, during that time, though, he does end up becoming a police officer. They say roughly about May of 73, ironically enough, when the ransacking started in Visalia. And they say that lasted roughly till about 76. And guess what division he was on? He was on the Burglary Task Force in Exeter. And during this time, now mind you, there are a lot. We could not possibly go through all of these ransackings. They're said to be right around 125 ransackings that happened from, you know, May of 73 till, you know, right around 75-ish. So, you know, you're looking at 2 years, 125 ransackings. Well, they say here the actual ransacking crimes went from May of 73 to January of 76. Up to, again, 125 ransackings, one murder and one attempted murder in that time period, that he was also a cop.
Right.
One of the murders was one that happened September of 75, Claude Snelling. And what do you got about that?
Did you know that his daughter was the 19-year-old that on July 3rd of 75... that he was prowling and peeping on. That he was kind of stalking her.
Yes, yes.
And that's the same girl that Claude Snelling.
Mm-hmm.
That was his daughter.
Right. I did hear that. Yeah. So, and there's a lot of other weird connections, you know, as well. Not so much with Snelling, but things that he did throughout this, you know, these years. And I don't remember offhand. I don't know if you have in your notes, Jody, you know, how, you know, he was killed. Because this was the one murder, some say, if mm-hmm. this is the same guy, the Golden State Killer, mm-hmm. Then this was his first murder.
Yeah, it said that around 10 o'clock, the girl's boyfriend was over, and he left around 10 p.m.
Mm-hmm.
About 2 a.m., she woke up feeling, like, pressure, and the guy was on top of her.
Right, okay.
She thought it was her brother playing a trick on her at first, mm-hmm. but then the stranger said that he would stab her. He drug her out of the house through the back gate and the carport. Her father came out to see what was going on. I mean, started yelling at him stuff, find
right.
out what was going on.
Right.
New thing. And as he was going towards them, he got shot twice.
And then he turned around and got shot, like, what, like three times in the back? Is that
no,
him?
That's
no,
not
no,
him.
No, no, no.
He only
okay.
got shot twice. Okay. And then he pulled the gun on the girl, and the girl said something and stuff, and he ended up just kicking her in the head. That's where I think the attempted murder come into play.
Oh, okay, right, right.
But he died at the hospital.
Snelling did, right. And then there was just a few months later, the attempted murder of Officer McGowan.
Mm-hmm.
And this incident, I think there was a prowler, and the cop, Officer McGowan, he was kind of being sneaky, and then snuck up by this guy,
mm-hmm.
shined his flashlight on him, and is like, "Hey, you know, freeze! What are you doing?" And I guess from what's said is that this guy was almost, you know, like a little kid who just got caught with his hand in the cookie jar. Oh no, please! Oh no!
Yeah, he jumped a fence,
and then he starts
all zigzag, screaming, "Don't hurt me!"
Right? I mean, just very kind of weird behavior. You would think there would be no verbal communication at that point. If you are this offender, you see this cop with a flashlight in front of you, he's, you know, probably already has his gun out, and you know, you think you'd just be hopping fences left and right.
Yeah.
That's not what happened, though. Well, you know, he starts eventually hopping fences. Mm-hmm. McGowan is, you know, it chases him, finally gets him cornered or something.
Well, he kept telling him that his hands were up. He's like, "My hands are up," but he was only putting
the one hand up.
He's fiddling in his pocket,
right, and ends up pulling out a gun and shooting
mm-hmm.
McGowan. And I believe that hit him what in the face, or where'd that hit him at?
I don't know.
I cannot remember offhand. But the pictures they showed, he had a patch on his eye. So you know, I just maybe assumed that it was in the face, but that eventually, you know, killed him. He was shot to death. Attempted murder. He was not killed by that. But from that point on, they, you know, it was like one of those things where, hey, do not, you know, this guy's probably got a gun. If you corner him, he will shoot at you. Which was later, you know, how they described the East Area Rapist, as well as the original Night Stalker, which a lot of people think, you know, the Night Stalker, well, that's Richard Ramirez. Well, no, this is the original one here. hey, before we go, actually, any further, because we're going to start getting into the East Area Rapist and those crimes and is very, very horrible. And during this little break, it's probably one of the longest breaks in podcast history, or at least in the history of this podcast. For about the next 20 minutes, you're going to hear the stories from different survivors and victims of the rapes that occurred in a time period that we're going to talk about after the break. Now, I do have to warn anybody, and I guess I'm especially talking to any females listening, and, you know, you have had the unfortunate, circumstances of, being in, raped or part of a sexual assault crime. Some of the stories you're going to hear during the break, I guess they could say, could trigger you. So just, be advised that there's going to be some pretty strong situational type, things being discussed, a lot of sexual assault, a lot of rape. So, just be mindful of that if you want to continue, after this break. So with that in mind, we are going to take a quick, it ain't going to be quick. Like I said, it's going to be about 20 minutes to hear some of the, victim survivors, of the attacks of what's now the person now known, as in our timeline here, the East Area Rapist. Stay tuned. We'll be right back right after this break.
I woke up with a hand over my mouth and I rolled out of bed. I just swung my arm. I said, "What are you doing?" He was going down the hall and he was just hitting me. And then I just pretended that he knocked me out, so he quit hitting me. And then I had socks stuffed in my mouth, blindfolded, gagged, hands tied, legs tied. And then, pulled me up like this, because I was on my stomach, and put me back in bed and said, "If you move, I'm going to kill you." So, lay there for 2 hours. And he came in, I think 5 different times or something like that over the course of the night and raped me. And while you're laying there thinking you're going to die, you just are pretty sure that, I remember just kind of being in shock. I'm just laying there on my stomach shivering because I had a fever, and you know how you get the chills and you shake, finally, after, our best guess is 2 hours, it went on a long time, at about 4:30 in the morning, I had heard a car drive away. And I started counting to 60 because I didn't have any concept of time. So I counted to 60 30 times. And I figured then a half hour would have gone by with no noise in the house. And I got up and didn't know if he was there. I used to say, and I'm sure that, who knows, that I remember saying when it was still going on, if they ever catch this guy, they should lay him on the floor and let everybody that he raped get to do whatever they want to him. I just thought that's what we should get to do. And then that thought kind of went away. But I thought, we should get to do what we want. We had to go through this. I don't think that I would need to hurt him. If he was caught, I don't need to get any revenge. I don't need anything like that. I just liked it there to be closure. But I have to say, it's felt pretty close to me for a long time. I'm always aware of anybody coming up behind me. And it's not a fear. I don't have a fear with that. I'm just aware. I'll look over my shoulder all the time. It's just the way... I'm sure that came out of it, but that's my, my rationalization that I can do all these things because I'm super aware of what's going on. I have to do a lot of self-talk when my husband's away for the weekend. I have to tell myself that there's somebody next door that's a single woman that stays home every night by herself and she hasn't been attacked. I have to do this every time he goes away, and he doesn't go away very much. Maybe at the most once a year. But I don't just peacefully go to sleep every night.
I was recently new to the neighborhood and in the house we had just bought, like maybe 3 to 4 months. And I was not really following the East Area Rapist at all. I knew that helicopters are out and it was in the paper, but I didn't know the different cities really. I did, because I was new to the area. On that particular night, my husband was home. We went to bed about 2 o'clock in the morning. Our bedroom door opens and all I see is a flashlight. I don't see a weapon or anything like that. It was basically, follow my instructions or I'm gonna kill you. And at first you're not awake and I'm thinking, am I dreaming? Is this really happening? And then it's like real fast, you're awake and he's on top, practically. So he throws some strings at me, asks me to tie up my husband, which I did. He comes over, he ties me up. Both of us are tied with our hands behind our back, and our ankles are also tied. At that time, he leaves the bedroom, and I can remember turning my engagement ring around. At the time, I'm still thinking, it's just going to be a robbery. In my mind, I'm still not putting it together.
So did you know about the East Air rapist case when this was all going on?
I knew about it, but I also didn't think that husbands were home at the time. I was not the very first one to have a husband at home, but I didn't make that connection. So that was another, he got even more brazen. He pushed the envelope. He was taking it to another whole level. So he left the bedroom, he went into the kitchen and got dishes, which is, people are saying the same things. So he brought the dishes, he put them on my husband's back, several plates, a bowl. At that time, he untied my ankles, told me to follow him. And he
Your
was-
hands are still tied?
My hands are still tied. I'm in a little teeny nightie. And I walk down the hallway. And as I'm walking down the hallway, I'm saying, oh my God, I'm gonna be raped. I knew by leaving that bedroom, it was gonna get worse.
Where did he take you?
He took me to the family room. And at that time, he went into the other bathroom, got a set of towels, he took the knife, cut the towel in half, and put it over the TV. So he wanted the light of the TV, but he didn't want it too bright. And I was on the floor in front of the TV.
Okay. So he wanted to see what he was doing.
Yeah, but he didn't want it bright enough to draw attention from the outside, is what my... And I had a blindfold over my eyes, so I never actually saw his face. I got an idea of his size was about 5'10", and he did have the ski mask on the whole time.
What did he sound like?
He didn't really talk to me. He mumbled, but by then he went to the kitchen. He started drinking beer, and I could smell beer, and he was in the kitchen. And then he started going through drawers. He'd leave that room and go back into the bedroom. He would be going through things, and I could hear a lot of noise. And then he came back. He had a knife in his hand. He decided to rape me and had the knife to my throat and saying if I made any sound or screamed or moved, I would be killed. And he also said to me that if your husband makes a sound, I'm going to cut his ear off and bring it to you. And I'm telling you, at that time, I'm saying to him, oh my God, I just want to live. Please don't hurt me. Please don't hurt me. I am not willing, but I'm not fighting. I'm just laying there. And I was praying. I was praying for God to take me, not experience what I was going to go through. So after the rape, I lay there for a long time. I started getting cold, but I could still hear him making noise, going through things. Then he came back and he says, I want your rings. And I couldn't get them off my hand. And I'm still hogtied. I'm still tied behind. And I said, go get some soap, go get some lotion. I'll get them off. So he brought that to me. I got off my engagement ring and my wedding band. And my engagement ring was a pair. And that's kind of unusual. Not very many people had a pair diamond. And so he took my husband's rings too. And then it was quiet, and I waited for a long time, and I thought, okay, I'm gonna get up. So I got up at that time, I ran into the bedroom. My husband says, I can't feel my hands. You've gotta get help. You've got, my hands are totally numb. So I went into the kitchen, and because of our front doors being a key to put in it and turn, with my hands behind my, I couldn't figure out how to do that. Our sliders had nails at the top going through, all the way through. I couldn't figure out how to get my hands. So at first, I'm taking knives trying to saw off the shackles. And then the slider that was next to the kitchen, the drape moved. And I realized he didn't shut the door all the way because I hadn't tried it. Mm-hmm. So I went over with my shoulder, I put it in the slider, and I moved it out of the way, half naked, waist down, go down the side of the house, out the gate, ran to a neighbor's house, rang the doorbell. The husband came down, gave me a bath, a jacket right away. He told his wife, call 911, and then he took one of his handguns, went to the house, and got my husband untied.
So your husband remained tied the whole time?
The whole time.
This was going on.
He was tied the whole time, so he never left that room.
Jane Carson Sandler and cold case investigator Paul Holes join me now. Welcome to you both.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for telling this story, Jane. It's got to be so disconcerting to you to know that after all this time, they believe he's still alive, he's still out there. May I ask you if there's any fear in coming on camera and talking about it so vocally?
Absolutely not.
Good for you.
No.
Take us back to the day it happened. Your husband had just left for work. It was broad daylight. It was the first thing in the morning.
6:30 in the morning. Yes.
What was the first sign you had that an intruder was in your home?
The garage door just closed. My 3-year-old son had just gotten into bed with me. And the next thing I knew, I heard someone running down the hall. And I thought maybe it was my husband. And I yelled out, "What did you forget?" And there was no answer. There was just a flashlight with this man then standing over top of me, with a light shining in my eyes, with a large butcher knife. And he had a ski mask on, black leather jacket.
Did he blindfold you?
Yes, he blindfolded my son and myself. He blindfolded us, he gagged us, and he tied us up. Ankles and our wrists tied up.
So the whole time you are sitting there thinking, oh my God, where's my son? What happened to my son?
He moved him. And I didn't even remember the rape. That was immaterial to the fear that I was feeling at that time. It was immaterial. I just kept thinking, where did he put my son? What did he do with him? What's he going to do with us? Because prior to the rape, he had this very strange behavior of tearing sheets, tearing towels. And I thought, is he going to hang us? What's he going to do with us? And again, it was, where was my son?
You were the fifth of some 45 rape victims.
Yes, ma'am. Number 5.
And now that you know, thanks to the good work by Paul and others, that he was, in fact, linked to at least a dozen murders.
Yes.
You must be grateful to be alive.
I am. I am grateful to be alive. But I'm so grateful for all of the wonderful, compassionate, caring investigators that have been working this case for so many years, and they've never let up.
And I wake up to this guy standing in my room, and he's got a revolver in his hand. I don't remember exactly the complete specifics of words that were said. Something was said to the effect, "Don't move or I'll kill you."
Like everybody else, I graduated from high school. I'm 18 years old. I'm still living at my parents' house, but I spend a lot of time over at my girlfriend's house. I got a job, and I had a regular income coming in, and I thought it was just time, you know, that I got my own place.
So now it's 1:30 a.m. Saturday morning on October 1st. For the first and only time that I could ever remember being with this girl, I went to bed before she did. And I wake up to this guy standing in my room. So the first thing I do is I look at this guy, and so I want to notice, you know, see who is this fuck in my house and shit, you know. And the first thing I see is he's standing there and he's holding a flashlight like this, and he's got a revolver in his hand. Now, I don't remember exactly the complete specifics of words that were said. Something was said to the effect, "Don't move or I'll kill you." Then he tells me to roll over and get face down. He had some like shoelaces in his pocket, and he instructed her to tie my hands. So then what he does is he tells my girlfriend to get up and go in the kitchen and to get some cups and saucers. I think there were two sets of cups and saucers put on the small of my back. He takes her off into the living room. Probably 10 minutes goes by, and he comes back in my room again. He puts the gun up to my head, and I believe he pulled the fucking hammer back, and I can hear the nice tightness of the fucking cylinder. So now he's been back. He's made two trips into my room. And whatever else he's doing in the other part of the house he's raping her. I hear some whimpering. I'm fucking 21 years old. That's my fucking girlfriend out there. This whole thing has been going on for 25 or 30 minutes, okay? I got a couple of friends. So they come over to my house and they pull up in the driveway and start beating on the door and ringing the doorbell and calling my name. And he's in the living room with her. What happened was they drove him off. He doesn't say anything. I don't know what he's doing. He flees. This is why I'm telling you that he was only there for 30 minutes.
Yeah.
He got interrupted. My friends leave. So things are really quiet for like maybe 5 minutes. I don't hear nothing. So then I call out, is he gone? And she says, I think so. So I'm up and I'm out of those bindings. And I reach underneath the mattress of my bed because he never knew that I was sleeping on a loaded handgun. And now I got a weapon. I look in the garage, nobody's in the garage. I look in the living room, he's not in the living room. And I look over and there's my girlfriend bound up on the floor. So I gotta look at her and I gotta see this look in her face. Fucking brutal, man, brutal. But I can't let her up yet because I don't know where this guy is. I'm not satisfied that this guy's not around. So I open the front door and I go out into the front part of the duplex and shit, and I look around on the street, stone fucking quiet. And at the top of my lungs, as loud as I could yell, and that's pretty loud, I drop the fucking F-bomb, hoping that he's gonna hear me running off in the distance, and then I discharge my weapon. And I'm hoping to this day, whenever I talk to him, if I ever get the opportunity to talk to him, I've often wondered if he heard that. So now I come back in the house, and I untie her. And I'm telling her, I'm so sorry, I'm so sorry, I'm so sorry.
The arrest of the alleged Golden State Killer has left one of his victims feeling empowered to speak out now. Joseph James D'Angelo is suspected of a dozen murders, as we've said, and close to 50 rapes committed across California in the 1970s and 80s. ABC 7 News reporter Leslie Brinkley met with Mary Buart again today, this time on camera, to hear the chilling details of her assault and her reaction now to this arrest.
Well, I woke up to the sound of a man's voice in my ear.
Mary Buart is 52 years old now, but she will never forget June 1979 when she was just 13 years old. She had just made it onto a Walnut Creek cheer squad when a man then known as the East Area Rapist came into her Walnut Creek bedroom and put a knife to her throat.
He tied my legs and tied my hands and gagged me with my training bra. He told me he was going to kill my family if I made any noise. And I just was as quiet as I could be. I just stayed there quiet. And he raped me.
Her sister was across the hall. Buart says she broke her feet loose after 45 minutes and ran down the hall to tell her dad what happened.
And I just blurted it out. And he flew out of bed. The look on his face was devastating.
The next day, she says her dad tore down the playhouse by her bedroom window.
Because apparently that's where he was watching me or stalking me.
From your playhouse?
Laying on top of the playhouse, he could see right into my bedroom window. He insinuated his filth and evil into our house, in my life, in our community, and brought terror to everybody.
While she's feeling empowered that the man accused of being the Golden State Killer is now behind bars facing murder charges, she's also frustrated that the statute of limitations has run out on the rape cases.
Karma. There is a whole lot of karma coming his way.
She says she hopes to use her experience to make positive changes toward justice.
Now he's brought his own evil into his own home, and he can just sit there with it.
Leslie Brinkley, ABC 7 News.
All right, welcome back. Night of the Living Dreads. We are talking, and by we, I mean myself, Otis B. Dreads, and Jody, Mrs. Dreads, is joining us, taking the place of Malice, taking care of some things at home. And all right, so we are talking the Golden State Killer, but you know, yeah, he's got a few other names that he's been known by over the years. One being the original Night Stalker, as I mentioned before the break. Another one being the Diamond Knot Killer, the type of knot that he would use to tie his victims up in his next little wave of crime and rape and pillaging. And, of course, the East Area Rapist, which is what we're going to kind of talk about now. Which is kind of, some would say, the second stage in this whole ordeal, because a lot of people, I think, believe that he was, you know, responsible for a lot, if not all, of the ransackings and burglaries that went on pretty much starting in 73, and some would say as early as 72, where there were some documented reports of prowlers and you know, breaking-ins and ransackings and all of that. So, you know, you have, if he was, let's just say, if he was one of, you know, the ones responsible for the ransacking. So we have like a serial burglar, a serial rapist, and that's where we're at now, serial rapist. This started, they say, in June of 76, and this is where it can get, you know, a little hard, I guess, if, you know, anybody has ever been a victim of something like this, listening to those, you know, reliving that horror and that terror. You know, I mentioned, Jody, the other night while we were, you know, listening to some of this, that listening to it, for me, I mean, this is like what horror movies are made of.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you have a masked intruder, a masked killer at some point, because as of now, just a quick recap, as of now, if the ransacker in Visalia is the same person as the East Area Rapist, he's got one murder under his belt so far, and that was Claude Snelling that we mentioned. You know, now, where was I going with that one? My head is just all over the place. Because, you know, there's so much information in this. It really is. And but we have, again, we have the East Area Rapist, which he comes to be known as, again, 50 sexual assaults, two murders in this time, and one attempted murder. So he stepped his murder game up to one. Now, one of the first instances that he has here is with the attempted murder of Rodney Miller. Now, I think it's important to note that, again, you know, during the Visalia ransacking, he was part of the burglary task force for the Exeter Police Department. Auburn Police Department in 1976, which ironically is when the East Area Rapist crimes begin, in June of 76. And it said from 76 to about August of 79, he was with the Auburn Police Department. The attempted murder of Rodney Miller, you want to talk about that one? You don't have much down there on him, do you? No? Well, I'll tell you a little bit about Rodney Miller. He he spotted a prowler that he anticipated and interpreted that this was somebody who was stalking his younger sister. He proceeds to take off after the guy, and as the prowler started to take and go around and dip behind a house, he was by a lighted up area. It was, you know, probably at nighttime, lighted up area. He stops, turns around, Rodney stops, is looking, and he said that was about the only time that he really got a good look at this guy. And it was just for kind of a split second. It was a little bit of light. He proceeds to chase him, gets close enough that he wraps up his legs, takes him down to the ground. He's getting ready to just start pummeling him, and the prowler pulls out a gun, shoots him in the gut. They say that the bullet is still lodged in Rodney's gut to this mm-hmm. day. This is one of the people that they say probably had one of the, you know, there was only a few you know, suspects or those who saw or had the best look at what this guy looked like, because he was very, very conscious of not letting his identity be known. You know, it was a self-preservation type deal. The following February in 78 is the story of Brian and Katie Maggiore. And this was a couple who was walking their dog. And now Brian, he was in the military. I think he was an MP. And they stumbled across, and their dog walking stumbled across a prowler. Someone sneaking around houses, blah, blah, blah. Brian takes off after him, and it's only to be assumed that his wife and the dog kind of, you know, followed in the general direction that Brian was chasing this prowler. It stops in the back of a yard. There's a little confrontation. Brian is shot. His wife starts to run. She is also shot. So there's two murders there. Now, before we hit 1980, those were the big ones. The attempted murder of Rodney Miller, the actual murders of Brian and Katie in 78. That was it for, you know, that time period of 76 up to about 79, 80. 79, right. But a few other key things happened. He lost his job at the Auburn Police Department. He was fired in August of 79 because he was caught shoplifting in July of 79. And I believe if that's the same time, I think he was shoplifting rope and dog repellent, I believe. And you know, you figure if you're working for the police department, you know, I don't think they really profiled him as, you know, being, you know, hurting as far as money goes. But so it just seems kind of weird that he would take and, you know, steal that. Don't seem like that would be too much. Now we're into the wonderful 80s. But October of 79, there's an aborted attack. Every once in a while, he found himself in situations where he either didn't get to, you know, complete what he wanted to, maybe he did part of what he wanted to, but there was an aborted attack in October of 79. December of 79, we have the doctors, Dr. Offerman, Robert Offerman, and Dr. Deborah Manning. Those murders. Do you know anything about those murders there, Jody?
Yeah, it says that at 3 a.m., a neighbor reported hearing gunshots. Heard one, and then three more, and then one more. Said that Robert was shot once in the chest and three times in the back, and Manning was shot in the back of the head.
It's like an execution style. Did you say it was kind of like an execution style? So, March of 1980, come Lyman and Charlene Smith. We heard some recounts of Lyman's daughter. I believe she was one of the ones on the... I'm not sure if that's the one I did or not. She might have been one of the ones talking in during the break. Again, you know, they're bludgeoned to death. Mm-hmm. A lot of these, you know, victims, Keith and Patrice Harrington, again. I mean, it's just, you know, horrible. You know, I mean, because this is where things really start to escalate, because he goes from the East Area, which is up in Northern California. He travels down to Southern California, and that's when the murders really become his deal, because there's no sexual assaults, although there are, but they're, I guess, grouped in under the murder umbrella, because mm-hmm. there were victims, female victims that were raped. They could tell there was sexual assault, and they were also dead. But murder becomes his really big thing at this point. I mean, there's no holding back. And the weird thing is later on they do realize that this East Area rapist and this original Night Stalker, this is the same person. And they've noticed that, you know, when these rapists and rapes were happening, and again, there's 50 sexual assaults. It wasn't just the attempted murder of Rodney and, you know, the Brian and Katie. There were 50 rapes during that time as well.
Mm-hmm.
So what they figured out was that, you know, this was a guy who, you know, what was only targeting single women. He didn't like there to be another, you know, male there. It complicates things. Too many people. When you're trying to commit a crime, there's too many people. So there it was all about women. And I got to back up a little bit, because, you know, there's a few talking points that I want to get your female perspective on. So of course, at that time, during this East Area, you know, rapist crime spree, the women were terrified, especially those that are, you know, single or just dating, don't have a live-in male companion. So they hold these town meetings, okay, and I mean, they're just people lining up at the door, 600-700 people, mostly women. I mean, there's a lot of males there as well, but it is mostly women because they seem to be the target of attack. Well, they proceed to, you know, let everyone, you know, look, you know, this guy, he's only, you know, he's only attacking, you know, it seems that he's only going after single women, those living by themselves, or blah, blah, blah. And this is published in a newspaper, okay, the Santa Monica Bee, or Sacramento Bee. And when this article comes out stating that, you know, the target seems to be, you know, women living in a house where there's not a man present, within a week later, the next victim was a couple. And going back to the after a few couples have gotten hit, again, there's more town meetings and blah, blah, blah. A gentleman stands up and starts, in a sense, chastising, you know, the men of these, you know, the husbands of these wives that were raped, or the boyfriends of these girls that were raped. And how could you do that? And how could you just, you know, let that happen? And blah, blah, blah. And it's, you know, well, within a few weeks of that guy and his wife were one of the next victims. So it told detectives and those investigating that this guy could have possibly been sitting in one of these town meetings.
Right.
Yeah, you're gonna have to scoot up a little. He was, you know, he knew who said it, what they said. And it was kind of like, yeah, I'll fix you. So we have, what is this? the Manuela.
Mm-hmm.
What do we know about her? I don't have anything on her. Or is that a him?
It's a her.
Her.
Yeah, she was in a sleeping bag, and he did rape her, and then he made her get back in the sleeping bag and bludgeoned her to death.
And you know, that was something that he started doing towards, the end of the 10 murders, is he would cover up his victims with a comforter or something and beat them to death there.
Mm-hmm.
Like that. That way the blood wouldn't splatter so much on him. Or anywhere else at that matter. So, obviously a very gruesome scene to walk in on. He has his first child in September of 81, but not before Sherry Domingo and Greg Sanchez meet their fate, and that would be in July of 1981. I have some things on them. That was pretty brutal. He enters the house, they say, probably from a window around the back of the house. He confronts the couple. Sanchez awakens and immediately jumps up, as you would think most people would. You kind of open your eyes, you hear some rustling, you open your eyes, there's a guy standing there, at the foot of your bed. He confronts him. There's a little scuffle. They said, by the way, that the blankets, there was some disheveling of things at the foot of the bed, which maybe indicated there was a struggle at the foot of the bed, like he came out of the bed after him. Sanchez gets shot, and he gets shot in the face. But it doesn't kill him. It only shoots him. It only hits him in the cheek. Mm-hmm. It just kind of, stuns him a little bit, and which, go figure, it would. And that's when, at the time, he was named the original Night Stalker, ONS. He turns to Sherry, is his wife there. Or I think, I don't even think they were married. It was a... boyfriend, I believe. Sanchez gets a second wind, gets up from being shot in the face, in the cheek, and pursues and, again, starts to attack the Night Stalker. And the original Night Stalker, that is. The fight somehow ends up in their bedroom closet. And this is where Sanchez met his maker. Because he was, they said, bludgeoned to death in the head by some, blunt object, blunt force trauma to the head. And unfortunately, Sherry met that very same fate. That was in July of 81. Now, here comes, kind of a, little bit of a, where things just, this always confuses cops when these murders stop. Now, before we get into the last known murder, which happened in 86, he was also one of those, as soon as I find it, he was also one of those ones that made phone calls,
mm-hmm.
not only to the police, but also to the victims. I mean, so much, and it's so creepy to the point that a victim of his in 1977 gets a phone call in 2001.
Mm-hmm.
Very strange. Here's one that happened. This was a phone call to the Sacramento County Sheriff's office, March 18th, 1977, they received three calls from a man claiming to be the East Area Rapist. None were recorded. The first two calls received at 4:15 and 4:30 p.m. They were identical and ended with the caller laughing and hanging up. The final call came in at 5 o'clock with the caller saying, "I'm the East Side Rapist. And I have my next victim already stalked, and you guys can't catch me." In December 2nd, 1977, a man claiming to be the rapist called the Sacramento police saying, quote, "You're never going to catch me, East Area rapist. You dumb fuckers. I'm going to fuck again tonight. Careful," end quote. The call was recorded and later released. And then there was a Merry Christmas call. But this one went to, I think, one of the previous victims, December 9th, 1977. A previous victim received a telephone call during the 1977 Christmas season, which she attributed to her attacker. The caller said, "Merry Christmas, it's me again." So, you know, it's pretty creepy. You could, you know, make a horror movie out of this stuff. This is just that. This guy was out of control. Watt Avenue, December 10th, 1977. Shortly before 10 o'clock on the night of December 10th, 1977, dispatchers from the County of Sacramento's Sheriff's Department and the City of Sacramento's Police Department received identical calls saying, "I am going to hit tonight, Watt Avenue." Both were reportedly recorded, and the caller was identified as the same person that placed the December 2nd call. Law enforcement patrols were increased that night in response, and at 2:30 a.m., sheriff's deputies spotted a masked man bicycling on the Watt Avenue Bridge. He eluded them, and I believe that was the murder where he stole a bike. It could have been. I think he stole a 10-speed at one of the sites. He was located again at 4:30 a.m. by city police. He discarded the bike, which was determined to have been stolen in Redding, California, and fled on foot. And then the most creepiest one, I think, out of all the ones that I've heard, is this one. The first known rape victim received a wrong number call asking for Ray on January 2nd, 1978. The call was recorded, and police suspect that it may have been the same caller who made a threatening call to her later that evening. The call was also recorded and identified by the victim as the voice of her assailant. The caller said, "Gonna kill you, gonna kill you, gonna kill you, bitch, 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 fucking whore." But to listen to that one, I mean, when he's like, "Gonna kill you." But before that, there was just like a long pause with this heavy breathing. And it's very creepy. Counseling service, January 6, 1978, a volunteer for the contact counseling service answered a call from a man claiming to be the East Area rapist who said, "I have a problem. I need help because I don't want to do this anymore." After a short conversation, the caller said, "I believe you are tracing this call," and hung up. Let's see. Is this the Denny? Yes, this is the Denny's ones. This is another interesting one, too. Later calls. In 1982, a previous victim who was working at a Denny's restaurant received a call at work from the rapist, during which he said that he would rape her again. According to Contra Costa County investigator Paul Holes, the rapist must have gone to the restaurant and recognized one of his victims working there. 1991, a previous victim received a phone call from the perpetrator and spoke with him for 1 minute. She could hear a woman and children in the background, leading to speculation that he had a family. Which I don't think I've heard anything about him having a wife. I'd have to look on the timeline. I know he was engaged at one time, but that did not work out.
He had two kids.
He did have two kids. So there was, and then there's a few more calls. But yeah, he was one of these guys that, you know, it was almost like a cat and mouse game with him. I see you looking. What do you want to throw in here?
I don't know. I'm just looking.
Okay. I just wanted to throw that in there before we got, you know, too terribly far into this, because now we're at Sherry Domingo and Greg Sanchez murders, again, July 81. There's a 5-year gap, which, again, always seems to confuse the hell out of cops. They don't know. Now during this time, they're looking. It wasn't until 1982 that, you know, California even got 911, you know, an emergency. So it's not like any of these past victims could have taken, you know, and called 911. The technology was really not there. They were actually inventing and coming up with new ways, like to pull a fingerprint off of human flesh. This is something that they were doing. They did have some DNA that they were able to extract from one of the rape scenes, or one of the rape crimes, I believe, and they used that. They didn't have the technology really to do anything with it. It's pretty much like a swab, mm-hmm. But they preserved it over the years. And then when the technology presented itself in the mid-80s and so on, they were able to take and break this out and start, you know, using the new DNA technology that was surfacing, even though it was still pretty much in its infant stage. They were able to start doing something with this DNA that had been preserved from the murders before. And what they found, Paul Holes, I believe was his name, he was able to connect that DNA with at least three of the murders.
Right.
And I can't offhand remember what murders they were, because there's just, you know, well, there's 13 of them. And so this, you know, this was the task for the investigators, the detectives. Okay, we have DNA. You would think if you had DNA, boom, it's like open and closed case, you know. But that wasn't the case. They had the DNA. They didn't have really any kind of, you know, solid identification, because the assailant never let any of his victims see him. They were either blinded first off by a flashlight. He had a ski mask on, and the victims were also a lot of, you know, most of the time blindfolded, gagged, and tied. There was, you know, it was very odd if you did get a glimpse of them. Yeah, that wasn't happening. And so all they really had was some sketchy sketches, and, you know, the DNA. So they had to go by pretty much his eyes. They had no other facial features. They didn't know what the hell he looked like. They didn't have a name for him, but they had his friggin' DNA,
mm-hmm.
and could not find this guy for, you know, 40 plus years. So during this 5-year gap, that's pretty much what's going on. They're trying to track this guy down. They're trying to figure it out. But something changes in his MO at this point, because, as I said, this guy was like a chameleon, okay? If he came across a situation and a hurdle, like, okay, he you know, he's planning to attack this woman who's by herself, and all of a sudden a guy comes over unexpectedly. You know, he's always having to change things up, which he did when he switched from just, you know, single women alone to couples, which increased the risk dramatically. But maybe that was the throw he was looking for. Something changed with him a little bit. After the incident with Greg, and here the guy attacks him, he shoots Greg in the face. The guy still attacks him. It was almost like he realized this is probably getting a little too much to try and handle two people, subdue two people, instead of one. The very next murder after this 5-year gap happens to be Janelle Cruz, a single woman. I don't know much about her death. I think it was basically, you know, ran in, raped her, and beat her to death. That was with, I think there was a wrench, a big wrench or something, mm-hmm. or a pipe wrench or something, I think they said, that was missing. The family notice was missing from the back patio, because there was no murder weapon there, but they knew it was something hard. It was a blunt object, because it completely destroyed her face.
Right.
And then the murders kind of stopped. And you mentioned he did have a couple kids. And in November of 86, Janelle was May of 86, by the way, his second born child,
mm-hmm.
Where second child is born, in L.A. Third child is born in 89. He separates from his wife in 91. And let's see here. They say during, 91 and, 92 to 2017, there's not a whole lot that they really know about this time and what he was doing, other than that, he was arrested for drunk driving.
Oh, and he was still making phone calls.
He was making phone calls during this time, yes. But, they don't know a whole lot about, what all else he was doing. Wasn't until March of 2018 that he is identified as a suspect via a public DNA base. They had his DNA, and if I'm not mistaken, they got it from canned or something that he discarded.
It was a mug.
A mug that something he drank out of. Because you leave, as it was mentioned in some things that I read and watched earlier, you leave your DNA everywhere. I mean, no matter where you go, your skin flakes off. You don't even know. Hairs fall. DNA is everywhere. And so they were kind of looking for that, because I think they were watching the area, and I think they had it about down to who they thought this could be, going by the descriptions and whatnot, and the sizes and the age, approximate age, and they narrowed it down to some people, and they got, like you said, a mug, and they were able to identify him as the ones who they, from the East Area Rapists.
Right, due to the DNA.
Due to the DNA, and even before that, they already knew there was a new name for him at that point, and that was, of course, the Golden State Killer, because the original Night Stalker and the East Area Rapist, they then knew that it was the same person. So his name, again, became the Golden State Killer. And this trial is still going on. I mean, actually, the trial hasn't even started.
Well, and it's only for the murders, because
it is.
Statute of limitation ran out on the rapes.
Yep. So I guess there's a level of satisfaction that these rape victims, can live with. Because listening to some of them during the break that we played, there's... You can tell how heartbreaking it is. I mean, because you just don't know if you're going to die. I mean, you have no idea. Is this going to be the night I die? Is this how it's going to fucking go down? Very. this guy definitely, I think, qualifies as an SMF, if I do say so myself. There's so much more that can be discussed about this, and I think we could talk about the murders and the brutality therein with these murders, and maybe we will do a show about that. This is something, again, that's ongoing, and here's something interesting that I found. The East Area, well, they didn't know him as that then. He was just Joseph James D'Angelo. Back in 1996, the local police department was doing a little sting operation. And D'Angelo was 50 at this point. And what they were doing was they were saying, hey, you want to win, free, tell them that they won free Super Bowl tickets and to come down here and pick them up, when it was actually a sting operation, because the cops are sending these notices out to people, you know, who may have had outstanding warrants or they didn't know, so that people would come in, they would, or they targeted people with outstanding warrants. So these guys are just pretty much literally turning themselves in, these dumb shits. Guess who one of them dumb shits was? D'Angelo. So he goes in there, and he was jailed and released, and the charges were, you know, later dismissed. At least that's what the court records show. Right in their hands. They had this guy. They had no idea that this guy was in any way, shape, or form connected. But just to think, in 1996, 10 years after the last murder, being Janelle, the cops have this guy in jail. Have no fucking clue it's him. No clue at all. Just a very strange case. And like I said, there may be a part two to this podcast, but I have ran my gums long enough on this podcast. But it's a very, very interesting case. What would you not agree?
Yes.
This is one of those, you know, if you're into like the true crime, and things of that nature, then this is right up your alley. This is the remarkable thing that, you know, this guy was just caught, you know, after, you know, 42 years or whatever it was of, you know, of crime sprees, of rapes and murders and, you know, burglaries. And this guy is finally put behind bars. A serial killer, you know, you can possibly see, you know, the trials and shit coming up in news feeds. And I don't know how much we'll see out here in the great state of Ohio, but... I'm going to be looking, I'm going to be Googling, and we'll give you updates, you know, as they come in. As we find shit out, we're going to let you know shit. So that's going to do it tonight, this 25th episode. Again, Joseph James D'Angelo Jr., check him out. And once again, there may be a part two to this. I'm going to have to talk to the good Malice, and... I'm sure that, you know, he always seems to find things, you know, in his research that, you know, I may have overlooked. So it works. So maybe, you know, he's got some things that he wants to add to this. Because, again, this was his idea. And I started looking at him like, wow, this guy was just caught last year, man. This is shit happening right now. This is actually current events, people. Current events. So, we'll keep you guys posted on that. I'm Otis B. Dreads, and for Jody, I'm going to wish you guys bid you guys a good night, and a good upcoming week. Jody, I want to thank you for sitting in for Malice, and always enjoy. I mean, next time you're going to have to let me get a word in edgewise. all right, that'll do it for us. NightLivingDreads.com. Night Living Dreads on Facebook. Gorehounds of Horror on Facebook. After Dark on Facebook. You know, there's more. Misfit Fiend Horror Club on Facebook. Cannabis Arcade with a K on Facebook. And of course, Night Living Dreads, no A, over there on Facebook as well. We'll talk to you guys next week.
Things no one knows. We're going to die.